Hello and welcome to Pay-Per-View episode 98, in which I analyse newspaper headlines and place events and headlines in their true context. The first subject for this episode is security and the internet. This is in the Daily Mail. Planes dropping out of the sky, your mobile rendered useless, just like your car. As a Netflix film portrays a nightmare that security experts insist is a very real prospect, how will you survive on the day an enemy state switches off the internet? An oil tanker plows into a tourist beach. Planes fall from the sky. Driverless cars run amok. The internet fails and the mobile network dies. Feral instincts take over as people fight for food, water, and medicine amid the ruins of civilization. That is the nightmare vision depicted in Leave the World Behind, Netflix's recent hit film starring Julia Roberts and Ethan Hawke, as a couple battling societal breakdown when the technology that underpins civilization collapses. It's fictional, but it touches on deep-seated real-life fears. The film is produced by Michelle and Barack Obama's company Higher Ground. The ex-president was closely involved in shaping the plot, which dramatizes many of the cybersecurity issues on which he was briefed during his 8 years in the White House. For our 21st century lives are almost entirely dependent on complex technologies that many do not understand and that can be so easily exploited by our enemies. Maintaining a car, for example, was previously a job for any competent motorist and their local mechanic. Now our vehicles are computers on wheels, their inner workings a mystery. We used to navigate with paper maps and landmarks, but with his car's sat-nav out of action, Ethan Hawke's character Clay Sanford is unable even to find his way to the nearby town. Our telephone system used to run on sturdy copper wires with handsets you could fix with a screwdriver. Now it is a branch of cyberspace. So too is finance. Remember when a credit card's embossed number left an imprint on a paper slip? Not anymore. Our payment system depends wholly on electronic encryption. What use is cash in the modern world? In the film, with the internet gone, it becomes a prized asset. If the technologies we rely on break down, many of us will be as helpless as Hawke's Clay Sanford. I am a useless man, he howls, as the crutch of technology is kicked from underneath him. A media studies professor, Clay is perhaps the epitome of modern professional cluelessness, bereft of the hands-on skills needed in a post-apocalyptic world where only the fittest can survive. A world in which oil, gas and electricity supplies have ceased, in which the taps are run dry, where supermarkets are empty, a looted shells. In this wasteland, communication is only face-to-face, the fastest form of transport is a pushbike, and modern healthcare is a distant memory. Our electronic devices, once indispensable, are no more useful than paperweights. So could it really happen? The harsh truth is that modern life is perilously fragile. We are just one weekly shot, one tank of petrol away from helplessness, starvation and death. How did we become so vulnerable? The internet was created so that academic computers could connect with one another. I'll come back to that point later when I give my analysis on all the articles at the end. Today it is the central nervous system of our civilization. It has brought untold benefits to our lives and the global economy, but our failure to think about security means that this miraculous progress has come with dangerous flaws. It is often hard, sometimes impossible, to identify other people with whom you are dealing online. This leaves the internet wide open to abuse from pranksters, fraudsters, terrorists, spies, and hostile states such as North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China. And you don't need to turn to Hollywood to see what this means in practice. Ordinary instances abound. For a start, when we receive an email, we cannot be sure that it is genuine. Spoofing a sender's address is child's play. Someone's creating a bogus website. This is a boon to fraudsters and other crooks who try to steal our money or personal information. Another example is the Hi Mum messages, in which children claim to have lost their phones and need help from a parent in paying an urgent bill. In fact, the money goes to a fraudster. These particular scams are so increasingly sophisticated that criminals are now using artificial intelligence deepfakes to mimic the voice of their victim's loved one. Yet fraud is just a small part of this sinister universe. On a far bigger scale is ransomware, in which attackers scramble vital databases to extort money from victims. Such attacks are crude but effective. They typically begin when someone unwisely clicks a link in an email. That enables malware and malevolent software to infect the victim's computer and its connected networks. Crooks will, for a price, then supply an electronic key that unscrambles the vital data. The ransom payment is of course made in untraceable cryptocurrency. The attackers do not care if they are putting careers, happiness, health or even lives at risk. They are interested only in financial gain. Last October, one such attack crippled the British Library. The Rysida cyber gang claimed responsibility and leaked private employee data, including passports and addresses, while demanding Bitcoin cryptocurrency to the value of £600,000. Hospitals and local authorities are also common targets due to the sensitivity of the information they store. In 2020, Redcar and Cleveland Borough Council resorted to using pen and paper after ransomware froze its files. And then, on another scale altogether, other terrorists and hostile states use similar software for political gain. Ultimately, the full-scale societal collapse depicted in Leave the World Behind is, from a technological standpoint, somewhat overblown. But as Kieran Martin, an Oxford University professor formerly at GCHQ, notes, attackers do not need to break into the sophisticated control systems that run our critical infrastructure, water, power grid, sewerage, phones, the internet. Instead, they can more easily cripple the administrative side of modern life. For example, in 2017, Russian ransomware NotPetya caused chaos in Ukraine before spilling around the world, nearly wiping out the computer system at Maersk, one of the world's biggest shipping companies. North Korea, meanwhile, caused catastrophic damage at Sony Pictures in 2014. This was to punish the media company for a satirical film depicting an assassination attempt on the regime's leader, Kim Jong-un, as well as wiping databases. Pyongyang leaked Sony's confidential files, including emails containing unflattering remarks about the temperament and ethics of some A-list Hollywood stars. Russia used a similar tactic to derail Hillary Clinton's 2016 electoral campaign by publishing a series of private messages that proved politically devastating. For example, campaign staffers, including Chairman John Podesta, had their email accounts hacked, and it was suggested that Clinton had been privy to audience questions before television debates took place. State-run attackers have even more sophisticated arsenals. The US and Israel developed a tool called Stuxnet that allegedly took 10 coders 3 years to create. The software was used to affect the centrifuges at the heart of Iran's nuclear weapons programs, making the fragile components spin irregularly, causing severe damage and leaving them wrecked. Netflix's Leave the World Behind and the 2020 novel by Ruman Alam, on which it is based, avoids any specifics about the nature of the attack that dooms its central characters. Viewers are left guessing whether the perpetrators are terrorists, a hostile state, or even conspirators within America. And that is an important point. Attributing cyber attacks can be hard. What looks like petty cybercrime can in fact be an industrial scale enterprise run by a terrorist group, a criminal gang, or the North Korean regime. Even when the guardians of our security know the source of a cyber attack, they may be reluctant to give details. Unlike armed conflict, the public rarely know the truth about who or what is behind an attack. The French authorities, for example, remain tight-lipped about a devastating cyber attack on a leading television network, TV5 Monde, in 2015, when all 12 of its stations were taken off air by hackers, although British spooks are in no doubt that Russia was the perpetrator. On Boxing Day, less than 2 weeks ago, the vital GPS satellite positioning system in the Baltic Sea region was disrupted. Again, the likely culprit was the Kremlin, says Elizabeth Brawl, a leading expert in these gray zone security attacks, but NATO countries in the region are saying nothing. Thankfully, commercial shipping and aviation survived the GPS disruption. And critical infrastructure here in Britain is well protected. A breakdown of our air traffic control systems last year, caused by an accident, not an attack, led only to inconvenience, cost and delay. We get annoyed by technical glitches, but actual physical harm is rare, says Professor Kieran Martin. But in our private lives, as so many scams and frauds have exposed, we are more vulnerable. Perhaps you should follow the example of American doomsday preppers by building our own bunkers, complete with hydroponic terrariums, small glass houses to grow food, generators and solar panels, independent water supplies, air purification systems, gold coins and a year's supply of canned and dried food. Indeed, Netflix's drama ends with the Sanford's daughter Rose abandoning her family to hunker down in such a space. If we were to go down this route, some level of preparation would be prudent: a battery-powered torch and radio, some food and drink, first aid and essential medicines, warm clothing, a stash of money and similar necessities would be wise purchases, but mental readiness is just as crucial. When a ransomware attack in May 2021 crippled the billing system at Colonial Pipeline, a fuel infrastructure company in America, the firm briefly halted operations. The effect on customers should have been minimal, but selfish panic buying triggered a serious shortage. It doesn't take much for people to start behaving extremely badly, says Professor Martin. Just think back to Britain's loo roll shortage in the early days of the COVID pandemic in 2020. There was no shortage, but customer stockpiling gave the illusion of chaos and spread the paranoia. This mental point is where Netflix's thriller really excels. The best drama is not the technological chaos, but the chaos inside the characters' heads. Stress and fear quickly expose their prejudice and paranoia and corrode their relationships. It is here that I worry Britain lags behind other countries. We need to boost not just our physical preparedness against our enemies, but also our cognitive resilience, our ability to make sense of unexpected events and to react to them sensibly. Countries such as Finland, which has in Russia a large and bellicose neighbour on its doorstep, have for decades educated the public and trained their decision makers in these techniques. Better resilience pays off whether you are dealing with technological breakdown, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, or even a pandemic. Belatedly, Britain is moving in the same direction. A version of the top-secret national risk assessment is now publicly available, highlighting scores of threats from hostile state activity to natural disasters and pandemics. A new emergency alert system introduced last year allows the government to send messages to millions of people's mobile phones in a crisis, and a resilience forum brings together public, private and voluntary groups to plan whole-of-society emergency responses. The group would do well to watch Leave the World Behind. Experts might pick holes in the plot, but if the cast's psychological plight prompts new thinking about our own vulnerabilities, Britain's will owe Julia Roberts and her co-stars a debt of gratitude. This article was written by Edward Lucas, who is the author of Spycraft Rebooted: How Technology is Changing Espionage. The next subject for this episode is some positive news. Yes, there is some. This is in the Telegraph. Good riddance to self-service checkouts, an infuriating invention. Given supermarkets almost always seem to be able to provide us with what we want, when we want it. Given supermarkets almost always seem to be able to provide us with what we want, when we want it. The conclusion that inevitably follows is that they are run by some very able people, yet none of them seem to be able to work out what should have been obvious. That a switch to self-checkouts would be followed by a rise in shoplifting. One survey of 2,500 shoppers revealed that 40% of them admitted to slyly pilfering the odd item, with many resorting to the banana trick of ringing up expensive fruits and vegetables as much cheaper ones. Now, however, the tide seems to be turning. Booths, a supermarket chain in the north of England, recently announced it will remove self-service checkouts from all but two of its stores. US stores have been doing the same, or placing 10 item limits on how much you can buy via a self-service checkout. Good riddance, I say. It isn't so much the rise in shoplifting which bothers me, appalling though it is, as constantly being made to feel like a shoplifter even when I am trying to pay. I have used these self-service checkouts hundreds of times now, often because there is no choice. But I can probably count on one hand the number of occasions I have succeeded in getting through without having to call an assistant. The unexpected item in the bagging area is quite often, well, a bag. Supermarkets say they want us to use our own bags and charge us a small fortune to use their own, but just try putting your own bag anywhere near the bagging area. It isn't always clear which way you're supposed to scan your stuff, with some going left to right and others going right to left, with the inevitable protest from the machine if you get it the wrong way around. Other things just don't seem to want to scan at all. The frustration is itself an invitation to shoplifters. Archie Norman, the former boss of Asda, has warned, with people becoming so fed up with trying to do the right thing, they decide to give up and pocket stuff instead. Obviously, supermarkets can sell their wares more cheaply if they can get away with fewer staff, but since they all now seem to need large numbers of employees hovering around the tills to check that we're not stealing their croissants, to confirm we are over 18, or just to reset a till which has gone haywire, you wonder how much money they are really saving. They are automating the wrong part of their business. It is the shelf stacking and the warehouses which should be automated, with real, living human beings retained for customer-facing roles. No doubt the technology will improve. Cameras are increasingly being used to spy on us at the checkouts. Though whether there is anyone actually watching us or whether they are operating purely on the panopticon principle, trying to make us behave by leading us to think we are being watched, is hard to say. Maybe one day the technology will be good enough to spot the difference between a russet and a Granny Smith, and we won't need to have to do the identification ourselves. But I don't want to be endlessly surveilled upon when I go shopping. I just want to pick up some groceries, pay for them and take them home without some dippy machine accusing me of shoplifting. I know that the Sharons and Traces of the checkouts used to be the butt of jokes, bywords for low ambition. I never guessed how much I would miss them. And on the subject of the COVID fake vaccine, here's some more optimism. This is an article on the BBC News website. COVID jab skipped by 44%, study of the entirety of the UK finds. More than 7,000 COVID-related hospital admissions could have been prevented in the UK in the summer of 2022 if the population had received the full number of jabs recommended, according to research in The Lancet. Some 44% of the UK population was under-vaccinated, with younger people among the most likely to skip doses. In a first, health records for everyone over 5 in the UK were analysed. The same approach can now be used to understand other diseases. The entire population of the UK is 67 million, and all those over the age of 5 had their anonymised electronic health data analysed for the Lancet study. It found that between June and September 2022, the percentage of people not fully vaccinated against COVID was 49.8% in Northern Ireland, 45.7% in England, 34% in Scotland, 32.8% in Wales. And that was based on the number of COVID vaccine doses recommended for different age groups. With about 40,000 severe hospital admissions related to COVID during that summer, the research estimates that more than 17% would have been avoided if everyone had taken up the offer of the vaccine and booster doses for which they were eligible. The research used data on COVID vaccinations and tests, as well as from GPs and hospitals, to track health data for the whole population. They then looked at the relationship between the under-vaccinated and severe COVID illness. They found that under-vaccinated people over 75 were more than twice as likely to be seriously ill with COVID than those who were fully protected. The article continues. There was also a link between skipping doses and hospitalisation and death rates in all age groups studied. Professor Sir Aziz Sheikh, study co-lead and director of the Usher Institute at the University of Edinburgh, said the research showed COVID vaccines save lives. Although vaccine uptake was high at the start of the pandemic, that declined over subsequent waves of the virus, and health officials were no longer clear about the overall picture. As new variants emerge, this study will help to pinpoint groups of our society in areas of the country where public health campaigns should be focused and tailored for those communities, Professor Sheikh said. The groups most likely to turn down the invitation to be vaccinated were younger people, men, those living in poorer areas, and those from ethnic minority groups. This was similar for all UK nations. The difference in rates of under-vaccinated between nations is thought to be because of overall population size, demographics, and political approach. Professor Cathy Sudlow, Chief Scientist at Health Data Research UK, a consortium of researchers who worked on the study, said collecting NHS data on this scale across the four nations of the UK had huge potential. We believe that we could and should extend these approaches to many other areas of medicine, such as cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, to search for better understanding, prevention, and treatment of disease. The next subject for this episode is, this is in the Daily Mail, teacher sacked after refusing to treat 8-year-old as a boy over concerns for child's welfare after head ordered her to go along with pupil's wishes. A teacher sacked for refusing to treat an 8-year-old girl as a boy will tell an employment tribunal over serious concerns for the child's welfare. She was ordered by the head teacher before the start of term to go along with the wishes of the pupil to socially transition under the guidance of controversial LGBT charity Stonewall. It meant calling her by a boy's name and using male pronouns, and also involved an ultimately futile attempt to keep her gender change a secret from classmates. The child, backed by her parents, was allowed to wear a boy's uniform and to use the boys' lavatories and changing rooms. Attempt to keep your gender change a secret from classmates. If you are wearing a boy's uniform, using the boys' lavatories and changing rooms. Did you not think they might notice? Troubled by the situation, the teacher, referred to as Hannah for legal reasons, raised the matter as a safeguarding issue, believing it endangered the child and other pupils in the short and long term. We hear a lot about protected characteristics. What about the right of a child to grow up? Hannah told the Mail on Sunday. It is heartbreaking, she said. She added that children are being supported by teachers and schools to believe that they are in the wrong body. She's bringing a case against the primary school in Nottinghamshire County Council, claiming she was victimised for whistleblowing and unfairly dismissed in 2022. The case begins in Nottingham on Tuesday. She said her sacking for wanting to protect vulnerable children from harm has torn her life apart and left her with the prospect of never being able to teach again. She has enjoyed 5 happy years at the school and her record is unblemished, but she notes with dismay how education has become increasingly politicised. In 2021, the school adopted training methods devised by Stonewall, which urges teachers to remove any unnecessary gendered language from the classroom. Hannah believes the toxicity surrounding the transgender debate has created a climate of fear in schools. Nobody is prepared to speak out or challenge decisions made without discussion, she said. She now works in a sandwich shop where we are more freely able to discuss these issues. She added, teachers are being bullied into not questioning trans-affirming policies when evidence shows that the actual result of the approach is to put the welfare of a child at serious risk. I am determined to pursue justice. Andrea Williams, chief executive of the Christian Legal Center, which is supporting Hannah, said, for years, parents and teachers who have raised safeguarding concerns over these issues have been ignored and disbelieved. Final subject for this episode is food. I've got a few articles about food here. This first one is in the Daily Mail. Ultra-processed foods are harmful to every part of the body. Biggest study yet links UPFs to 32 illnesses, including cancer and heart disease, as experts call for biscuits, cakes and sweets to be treated like cigarettes. Diets high in ultra-processed food may be harmful to every part of the body, a major review of research found. Eating a lot of foods, such as ready meals, sugary cereals and mass-produced bread, is linked to an increased risk of 32 health problems, including cancer, type 2 diabetes and mental health disorders. Often high in fat, salt and sugar, and low in vitamins and fiber, researchers found convincing evidence that higher consumption was associated with a 50% greater risk of dying from a heart attack or stroke. In the biggest analysis of evidence to date involving 10 million people, researchers found those eating the most had between a 40 and 66%. Researchers found those eating the most had between a 40 and 66% increased risk of dying from heart disease. They were also significantly more likely to be diagnosed with obesity, lung conditions, and sleep problems. Likening it to tobacco, they said public policies and actions are essential to curb intake and called on public health officials to urgently develop guidelines and best practice for ultra-processed foods. In a linked editorial, they suggest foods are clearly labelled when ultra-processed. UPFs refer to items which contain ingredients people would not usually add when they were cooking homemade food. These additions might include chemicals, colorings, sweeteners, and preservatives that extend its shelf life. Restrictions should be placed on advertising and sales prohibited in or near schools and hospitals, they say. Governments need to adopt national dietary guidelines recommending varieties of minimally processed foods, they say, while taking steps to make freshly prepared meals cheaper and more accessible to all. The UK is the worst in Europe for eating ultra-processed foods, making up an estimated 57% of the national diet. They are thought to be a key driver of obesity, which costs the NHS around £6.5 billion a year. Often containing colours, emulsifiers, flavours and other additives, they typically undergo multiple industrial processes, which researchers found degrades the physical structure of foods, making it rapid to absorb. This in turn increases blood sugar, reduces satiety, being satisfied basically, and damages the microbiome. The community of friendly bacteria that live inside us on which we depend for good health. Food additives like non-nutritive sweeteners, modified starches, gums and emulsifiers also seem to affect the microbiome, levels of gut inflammation and metabolic responses to food, which may also increase risk of heart attack and stroke. An umbrella review conducted by academics in Australia analysed 14 review articles published in the last 3 years which associated consumption with poor health outcomes. There was convincing evidence higher intake was linked to a 50% greater risk of death from cardiovascular disease, a 12% greater risk of type 2 diabetes, and a 48 to 53% greater risk of developing anxiety. There was highly suggestive evidence that eating more ultra-processed foods can increase chances of dying from any cause by a fifth, according to findings published in the British Medical Journal. This was also the case when it came to obesity, type 2 diabetes, sleep problems, and dying from heart disease, which all shared between a 40 to 66% heightened risk. Researchers from Deakin University, Australia, also found a 22% greater risk of developing depression and 21% greater risk of death from any cause. The evidence between UPF intake and asthma, gastrointestinal health, some cancers and intermediate cardiometabolic risk factors remains limited, they said. In an accompanying editorial, academics from Sao Paulo, Brazil said, overall, the authors found that diets high in ultra-processed food may be harmful to most, perhaps all, body systems. They wrote, no reason exists to believe that humans can fully adapt to these products. The body may react to them as useless or harmful, so its systems may become impaired or damaged depending on their vulnerability and the amount of ultra-processed food consumed. They added, it is now time for United Nations agencies with member states to develop and implement a framework convention on ultra-processed foods analogous to the framework on tobacco. Further research to determine the different mechanisms by which these foods impact health is also vital. They said we should not delay policymakers from making urgent changes. Scientists said there were limitations to the study, including inconsistent data collection methods in the original research. Commenting on the findings, Gunter Kühnle, Professor of Nutrition and Food Science, University of Reading, said many studies also show that people who consume a lot of ultra-processed foods also have an unhealthy lifestyle and therefore a higher risk of disease. Although many studies attempt to adjust for this, it is virtually impossible to do so. The study, while observing multiple increased health risks due to diets of ultra-processed food, cannot prove consumption of these foods actually cause any of the health problems identified. Part of the problem is that people who eat large amounts of ultra-processed food tend to be both unhealthier in general and poorer factors that may worsen their health independently and influence or exacerbate the results. Another factor is the potential that ultra-processed foods may not be directly damaging health, but are instead leading people to eat less nutritious foods that could be driving the results. The other factor is how some ultra-processed foods might be worse than others. Experts have previously complained about how nebulous the term ultra-processed food is, and that it does not distinguish between a ready meal packed with fat, salt, and sugar, and a whole meal loaf of bread. Quality of evidence linking diets at high in ultra-processed foods to health issues is also an issue. The BMJ review graded the quality of the evidence behind observed rises in health problems on a scale of very low, low, moderate, and high. Only a few health issues observed reached a moderate quality of evidence. The vast majority were low or very low. A government spokesperson said, "We're taking strong action to encourage healthier food choices and to tackle obesity, recognising that it is the second biggest cause of cancer and costs the NHS around £6.5 billion a year, while respecting the importance of individual choice. We have introduced calorie labelling on food sold in restaurants, cafes and takeaways to empower people to make informed personal choices about their lifestyle. And thanks to our salt reduction programme, the amount of salt in food is fallen by around 20%. Pre-packed foods are required to set out a variety of information to aid shoppers, including a list of ingredients and nutritionals." This next article is about growing food. Homegrown food, this is in the Telegraph. Carbon footprint of homegrown food, 5 times greater than those grown conventionally. Growing your own food in an allotment may not be as good for the environment as expected, a study suggests. The carbon footprint of homegrown foods is 5 times greater than produce from conventional agricultural practices such as rural farms, data show. The carbon footprint of homegrown foods is 5 times greater than produce from conventional agricultural practices such as rural farms, data show. A study from the University of Michigan looked at how much CO2 is produced when growing food in different types of urban farms and found that, on average, a serving of food made from traditional farms creates 0.07 kilograms of CO2. The impact on the environment is almost 5 times higher at 0.34 kilograms per portion for individual gardens, such as vegetable patches or allotments. The majority of the emissions do not come from the growing of the food themselves, the scientists say, but from the infrastructure needed to allow the food to be grown. Researchers grouped urban agriculture sites into 3 categories, individual or family gardens, including allotments, collective gardens such as community gardens, and larger commercial-orientated urban farms. Jake Hawes, a PhD candidate at Michigan and first author of the study, said the most significant contributor to carbon emissions on the urban agricultural sites we studied was the infrastructure used to grow the food. From raised beds to garden sheds to pathways, these constructions had a lot of carbon invested in their construction. Poorly managed compost and other synthetic inputs can also be important contributors, though they were not the majority on most of our sites. The study, published in the journal Nature Cities, recruited 73 urban agriculture sites around the world, including Europe, America, and the UK, and conducted a comprehensive life cycle assessment on the site's infrastructure, irrigation, and supplies. Fruit was found to be 8.6 times more eco-friendly when grown conventionally compared to in a city, whereas vegetables were at 5.8 times better for the environment when left to the professionals. But some crops have a lower carbon footprint than others and can help green-fingered members of the public make their allotment or garden better for the environment. Tomatoes grown domestically, for example, have a lower carbon footprint than conventional farming, as does asparagus. Likewise, asparagus, which is most often flown in from abroad and thousands of air miles, is a source of large carbon emissions if grown conventionally. We find that urban farmers and gardeners can reduce their net impact by focusing on foods that are high carbon in conventional agriculture, Mr. Hall said. 2 examples of this that we identify are greenhouse-grown crops, including many tomatoes, and crops that are often flown in from across the planet, such as asparagus. The scientists also found that they can make their garden and at-home farming better for the environment by repairing their infrastructure as much as possible and not replacing it unless absolutely necessary. Two-thirds of the carbon footprint of allotments is created by the garden itself, data show, and building it to endure tough winters for several years can reduce the impact. Gardeners should also try and build their site with recycled or second-hand materials wherever possible, with emissions being cut by more than half if waste from other parts of a city were upcycled for the beds and sheds, for example. This study was published in the journal Nature Cities. The next food-related article is about farmers. Very topical subject at the moment, of course. This is in the Daily Mail. Farmer is paid £1.5 million to stop rearing pigs to meet environmental rules so that 5,000 homes can be built nearby. The deal is part of a move to reduce the amount of harmful nutrients flowing into waterways in Norfolk and to get house building moving again. The pig farm is on either side of the A47 bypass south of Norwich. By closing it down, the reduction in pollution means that officials will be able to grant permission for 5,000 homes elsewhere in the country, in the county. Under a directive issued last year, local authorities are obliged to find ways to offset the impact of pollution on waterways caused by new developments. So-called nutrient neutrality was held by environmentalists who argued it would limit the amount of damaging substances in rivers and lakes, such as nitrogen and phosphorus. The government attempted to stop the reckless plan, arguing it would hold up much-needed house building, but it was forced through the House of Lords by Labour and Liberal Democrat peers. The huge deal in Norfolk has now raised concerns that farmers elsewhere will be paid to effectively sit on their hands, while the UK's food security, the amount of homegrown produce available for our tables, will be further weakened. Local authorities cannot approve new developments in some areas unless they offset the environmental impact caused by new homes, including increased sewage and detergents from washing machines. Councils have been looking for schemes that meet this requirement, and Norfolk's solution was to pay the farmer to stop rearing pigs. The authorities will pay him through Norfolk Environmental Credits Limited, but hope to claw back the money from developers who will pay NEC Limited for environmental credits, giving them the right to build their housing schemes. Seen as an environmentally neutral scheme, the farmer will essentially be paid to stop polluting waterways and balance out the pollution that comes from new homes. Mark Shaw Farm, which sits by the A47 bypass south of Norwich, rears up to 2,000 pigs every year, producing nutrients that run into two nearby rivers. It remains unclear what will happen to the pigs, but they will likely be sent to abattoirs for their meat, so the business will be run down accordingly. Owner James Daniels told the Mail that people thought he was receiving an obscene amount of money for quitting his job, but he insisted he was doing everyone a favour by helping the environment. He said, "It really makes me angry when people say I'm profiting from this. It's compensation for giving everything up. I'm the second generation of my family on this farm. After my father got it in 1950, my son wanted to take it over." The article continues. Covenants would limit Mr. Daniel, 66, to using the land for arable crops, hay, or sowing it with grass seed or wildflowers. He added it would become a haven from nature, saying, "The money is only going to pay me for 8 to 10 years worth of putting pigs on there. That was my living." But independent South Norfolk councillor Clayton Hudson said, "My concern is about openness and transparency with this potential use of public money. And I'm not sure stopping a pig farmer from putting nutrients in the system only to replace that with more development solves the issue. Nutrient neutrality was brought in under European Union planning rules. Natural England issued a directive last year which stated that house building could not proceed in 27 catchment areas across England unless offsetting was put in place. The government's attempt to ditch the scheme was prevented by the Lords vote. Prior to the vote in the House of Lords, Housing Secretary Michael Gove and Environment Secretary Theresa Coffey have been pushing to end what they called defective EU laws in which require developers to offset any extra nutrient pollution they cause in sensitive areas. Mr. Daniels will be compensated by Norfolk Environmental Credits Limited, a joint business venture between Norfolk Councils and Anglian Water. The local authorities are borrowing millions to lend to the company for the mitigation schemes. Developers will buy credits from NEC to offset nutrients created by the house building schemes. Council chiefs claim this will cover their outlay. Phil Courtier, director of a place at Broadland, the South Norfolk District Council, said, "We are on the cusp of finalising a deal that will be the first of its kind in the country to release a significant number of homes and improve the environmental quality of the Norfolk Broads and the River Wensum." South Norfolk Council leader John Fuller and Breckland District Council counterpart Sam Chapman-Allen previously criticised the offsetting scheme, claiming it was putting 41,000 homes on hold across the county. Mr. Fuller added it meant organisations like DEFRA, Natural England and water companies were able to avoid doing their job to clean up rivers and instead could pass the buck to councils which lack the power, responsibility and enforcement powers to do so. But Gareth Dalgleish, Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Director of Nature Recovery, said any weakening of environmental protections would have a devastating effect on our Norfolk rivers, streams and wildlife, already under huge pressure from sewage and farm pollution. And Green County Councillor Jamie Osborne added, "We need better regulation to prevent the dumping of toxic waste into our rivers, not a free pass for developers to pollute them even more." The article continues. Official figures last year showed the UK imports 46% of the food it consumes. And finally, in the food-related articles, people who don't like meat or dairy. Veganism, this is in the Daily Mail. Harvard doctor says animal products are essential for mental health in blow to veganism, the brain needs meat. Meat is essential for warding off depression and anxiety, a top nutrition expert has revealed, sending a blow to veganism. Dr. Georgia Idey, a Harvard-trained nutritional and metabolic psychiatrist and author of Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, studies the relationship between what we eat and our mental and physical health. And despite the health halo the vegan diets have been given in the last few years, she claims that giving up meat could be detrimental for mental health. "The brain needs meat," she told Cairo News Radio. "We're used to hearing that meat is dangerous for our total health, including our brain health, and plants are really the best way to nourish and protect our brains. But the truth of the matter is that it's actually that's upside down and backward." Dr. Ide said that while getting enough protein has long been a concern surrounding vegan diets, eating meat is about more than protein. "It's actually less about protein and more about all of the other nutrients that are inside meat," she said. "You can get your protein needs met through a vegan or vegetarian diet if you plan it carefully. Proteins are made up of chemicals called amino acids, which build and repair muscles and bones. While animal products like eggs, meat, cheese and Greek yogurt are high in protein, it can also be found in vegan options like lentils and broccoli. But many of the other essential nutrients are much more difficult, if not in some cases impossible, to obtain from plants," Dr. Ide said. She noted that meat is the only food that contains every nutrient we need in its proper form and is also the safest food for our blood sugar and insulin levels. These nutrients include vitamin B12, omega-3 fatty acids, zinc, choline, iron and iodine. Vitamin B12, for example, helps with the formation of oxygen-rich red blood cells and DNA. However, it has also been linked to regulating mood-boosting serotonin, which helps with sleep as well, and low levels of serotonin have been linked to increased risks of depression and anxiety. Additionally, a review in the journal Frontiers in Pharmacology found that lower levels of zinc were associated with depression, as zinc can reduce inflammation in the brain. Several studies have suggested that meat eaters have better mental health. A 2021 systematic review of 18 studies compared those who do and don't eat meat. The research included 160,257 participants aged 11 to 96, including 149,559 meat eaters and 8,584 meat avoiders. Of those, 11 studies found that meat-free diets were linked to worse mental health outcomes. One of those studies found that vegetarians had a 35.2% chance of developing major depression compared to 19.1% for meat eaters. Additionally, vegetarians had a 31.5% chance of developing an anxiety disorder compared to 18.4% for meat eaters. One study published in 2022 surveyed 14,000 Brazilians between 35 and 74 years old and found those who followed a vegan diet were twice as likely to be depressed even if they had similar nutrient intakes to carnivores. And a meta-analysis published in 2020 and including 160,000 meat eaters and 8,500 meat abstainers also found those who cut meat from their diet were significantly more likely to be depressed. Despite gaining a health halo over the years, emerging research suggests that vegan diets could have other lasting health consequences. A 2023 report from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, for example, looked at more than 500 studies and concluded that animal sources of food offer crucial sources of much-needed nutrients. The agency noted that these macro and micronutrients are hard to find in the required quality and quantity if following a vegan diet. Additionally, meat, eggs, and milk are particularly vital for children, young people, and the elderly, as well as pregnant and breastfeeding women. A 2019 paper also noted that a deficiency of vitamin B12, which is more common in vegans, could raise the risk of stroke. This was because its absence inhibits the clearance of proteins from the bloodstream, leading to inflammation, which in turn raised the probability of blood vessels being damaged. This is a key risk factor for stroke. Adults need about 2.4 milligrams of vitamin B12 a day to function normally, US officials say. Vegetarian women have a higher risk of breaking their hips in later life compared to meat eaters, research suggested last year. A study of more than 26,000 middle-aged women has revealed those who do not eat meat and fish have a 33% higher risk of hip fractures. This could be because they have a lower intake of nutrients that are linked with bone and muscle health, the researchers said, and it reinforces advice that vegetarians should fortify their diets with key nutrients, they added. A team from Leeds University investigated the risk of hip fracture in occasional meat eaters, pescatarians who eat fish but not meat, and vegetarians compared to regular meat eaters. Among 26,318 women, 822 hip fracture cases were observed over roughly 20 years, meaning around 3% of women experienced them. Analysis published in the journal BMC Medicine found that after adjusting for factors such as smoking and age, vegetarians were the only diet group with an elevated risk of hip fracture. The team also discovered the average BMI among vegetarians was slightly lower than the average among the regular meat eaters. Previous research has shown a link between low BMI and high risk of hip fracture, which could help explain the finding. Lead author James Webster said vegetarian diets can vary, with some still being unhealthy. Our study highlights potential concerns regarding risk of hip fracture in women who have a vegetarian diet, he said. However, it is not warning people to abandon vegetarian diets. As with any diet, it is important to understand personal circumstances and what nutrients are needed for a balanced, healthy lifestyle. Vegetarian diets can vary widely from person to person and can be healthy or unhealthy, just like diets that include animal products. However, it is concerning that vegetarian diets often have lower intakes of nutrients that are linked with bone and muscle health. These types of nutrients generally are more abundant in meat and other animal products than in plants, such as protein, calcium, and other micronutrients. Low intake of these nutrients can lead to lower bone mineral density and muscle mass, which can make you more susceptible to hip fracture risk. So how do all these subjects connect? The internet came from military technology. I recommend a great book on this subject entitled Surveillance Valley by investigative journalist Yasha Levine, which looks at the military history of the internet and Silicon Valley companies like Facebook, Google, YouTube owned by Google, etc. Not least and Twitter. I'll come to Twitter. And this involved fundamentally DARPA, the technological development arm of the Pentagon. As I've said many times over the years of this podcast and over the last 18 years now, there is a massive technological disparity between the technology that actually exists and the technology that we see in the public arena at any given time. The internet was known about in 1969. When it was apparently, the World Wide Web anyway, at least, was said to be invented in 1989. The internet was known about in 1969 when an insider of the global cult that I write and talk about, I'm just in the middle of researching a new book at the moment, which is going to look at the history of this global cult, called Dr. Richard Day, gave a speech to a meeting of pediatricians in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, talking about how the world would change because he was connected to those who were planning to change it, especially the Rockefeller family, through his position as an executive of the Rockefeller organization Planned Parenthood, a eugenics operation, which is no surprise because the Rockefellers, along with their longtime friend Bill Gates, whose father, William H. Gates, was an executive of Planned Parenthood. Bill Gates is also obsessed with eugenics and depopulation. This is the same Bill Gates who said every man, woman, and child on the planet must get vaccinated to be protected against COVID-19, a virus that has never been proven to exist, as I've detailed in this podcast many times and in Reality Check over three lengthy chapters. And I also look at the COVID fake vaccine in one of those chapters. I say fake vaccine because it fails to meet any previous criteria of a vaccine. This is the same Bill Gates who funded and promoted that vaccine, and the same Bill Gates who funds the MHRA in Britain, which gave permission for the fake vaccine to be rolled out in Britain. In Reality Check, which is now available everywhere as an ebook, Amazon, everywhere, I examined the jaw-dropping influence Bill Gates had during the COVID era. Anyway, Dr. Richard Day in 1969, in that meeting, said many things which have turned out to be true, including that people would be able to interact with their television and make purchases on their television. He was describing smart TVs and, by extension, the internet in 1969. George Orwell was describing TVs with cameras that watch you, smart TVs, in 1948 in his novel 1984. People would be stunned to see the disparity in technological capability in the underground bases and unpublicized projects compared with the technology in the public arena. The public don't get access to military technology unless there is a benefit for the cult, and the internet is no exception. In the Daily Mail article about technology and a cyber attack, which I read earlier, it says the internet has become the central nervous system of our civilization. That was always the plan. The cult's agenda is to control everything from a central point through technology. Former CIA director David Petraeus talked about the Internet of Things, where everything is connected to and controlled by the Internet. The Internet of Things is described and defined as the network of physical objects, things, that are embedded with sensors, software, and other technologies for the purpose of connecting and exchanging data with other devices and systems over the Internet. And when you look at the gathering smart grid of smart and other technology, it is this very Internet of Things. The cloud is another name for it. Smart grid, Internet of Things, the cloud, they're all basically the same thing. The Internet is an absolutely vital foundation of human control, not just because of surveillance, profiling and data tracking manipulation, but also because of the transhuman agenda. The internet is designed to be connected to the gathering smart grid of wireless technology, which humans will be connected to via the inhalation and absorption of smart dust, not least from chemtrails from the sky, not contrails, which disappear from the back of jet airplanes, but chemtrails, which stick around and expand and contain metals of various kinds. And smart dust, nanotechnology, microchips, implantables, and other body inserts are designed to connect the human body and the human to the cloud, the technological sub-reality, which is what the cloud is. This is already happening before our eyes, but we've seen nothing yet. This is known as the Internet of Everything, when the human mind is also connected. The Internet of Everything is designed to be run by AI out of Israel, specifically the Beersheba cyber complex and Unit 8200. I detail in Reality Check why I say that if there is a massive cyber attack, that people like Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum have warned about, then we should look at Israel as a possible origin of it. I talk more about a cyber attack in an episode called Cyber Hacking, and the cyber attack is planned to affect electricity grids and be a massive crisis to respond to, because the plan is to hit the global population with so many shocks and crises, some of them actually not happening but claim to be, see COVID, and other real ones like a cyber attack, to weaken humanity and so devastate them financially and economically that the cult can just say, right, you've had all this devastation, these are the solutions, and it will be the agenda of this global cult. The cult's agenda seeks an end to small and medium-sized businesses. The plan is that only giant corporations will run and produce everything. The COVID hoax has caused massive devastation to jobs and businesses, and that was the plan, but they're not finished yet. The idea is to delete the ability of people to earn a living. AI, automation, and robotics are taking over the workplace. The cult seek a three-tier society. The cult in absolute luxury, even more than they are now. The population in absolute poverty, and I mean poverty. And in the middle, a vicious, tyrannical, and in the end, robotic police military, enforcing the will of the global cult on the population. The cult plan to offer a guaranteed basic income, which you will only get if you do what authority says, and that includes taking all the vaccines they demand that you take, or you won't be able to purchase, work, travel, or anything else. So with that background, let's take a look at Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter. It was a real head-shaker moment to see people celebrating the acquisition of Twitter by cult frontman Elon Musk. That's what he is, he's a cult frontman, who is a sales pitcher for the agenda. Musk bought Twitter for roughly $44 billion in October 2022. Musk released a batch of internal documents known as the Twitter Files to a select group of journalists in late 2022. The files revealed evidence of collusion between tech companies, politicians, and the permanent government, or deep state, as some like to call it. CEO of Twitter, now appointed by Elon Musk, Linda Yaccarino, has worked previously with the World Economic Forum. So you're exposing involvement by the deep state with Twitter, and then you're appointing someone who works with the World Economic Forum. This is the Linda Yaccarino who talks about freedom of speech, not freedom of reach, which is that you can say what you like, but if it's deemed to be hate speech or dangerous by whose criteria, then only a limited number of people will be able to see it. That's the Twitter of free speech absolutist Elon Musk. Anyway, the Twitter files showed that there was involvement by the deep state in Twitter. They were deciding what could be posted and what could be seen and what could not be seen on Twitter. Musk signed an agreement to purchase Twitter in 2022 before realizing the platform was full of bots, a computer program imitating people, real people, and tweeting pre-programmed content in favor of the cult's agenda and attacking people, challenging it, and just doing other things that real people are not doing. So Musk said, I don't want to buy it because of the bots. But Twitter took Musk to court to force him to honor his signed obligation. So I've got a question. Why would the deep state, in control of censorship on Twitter, which is why it was created, same with Facebook, same with YouTube, same with Google, same with all these Silicon Valley organizations, internet giants, they've got what they want. They've got the censorship. Why would they then not only sell to free speech absolutist Elon Musk, but take him to court to force him to buy it if he really was a free speech absolutist and they knew that that's what he was? Chinese social media takes the form of WeChat, described as the everything app used for messaging, social media, payments, subscriptions, utility bills, food deliveries, plane and train tickets, ride hailing, and far more. Elon Musk says he wants X to become the new WeChat. Life in China is impossible without a WeChat account. Musk said, "You basically live on WeChat in China because it's so usable and helpful to daily life. And I think if we can achieve that, or even get close to that at Twitter, it would be an immense success." So, being suspended or banned from WeChat has been described as a digital death. Musk, the alternative media hero, is not trying to build a social credit system in the West through X, is he? Surely not. He's a free speech hero. Another Musk quote. "Twitter was acquired by X Corp both to ensure freedom of speech and as an accelerant for X, the Everything app. This is not simply a company renaming itself, but doing the same thing. The Twitter name made sense when it was just 140 character messages going back and forth, like birds tweeting. But now you can post almost anything, including several hours of video. In the months to come, we will add comprehensive communications and the ability to conduct your entire financial world. The Twitter name does not make sense in that context, so we must bid adieu to the bird." And when he acquired Twitter, Musk tweeted that the bird is free, in other words, free speech. And since that time, we've seen that it's not quite as free as he claimed. So could the reason behind the rebranding of Twitter to X be about this very planned social credit system? I've also heard that Musk reportedly wants to turn X into an online banking or cryptocurrency system. It's worth noting that one of Musk's early projects was PayPal, which he co-founded with Peter Thiel, or Thiel, who's also a frontman for the global cult. WeChat's payment function allows users to pay for goods with the app. Users scan a merchant's QR code to pay using cash in their WeChat wallet, which is connected to their bank account. Users can also easily send money to each other via WeChat messages. The QR code is a central part of the Chinese social credit system, and we're seeing the QR code becoming ever more prominent in the West for the same reason. Scan your phone and you can do this with the QR code. That's to get people used to it, but it's planned to be part of a Western social credit system. The idea is to bring the QR code in with fun, innocuous things that people can scan their phone with the QR code and they can get this extra content or do this, which gets people used to seeing it and using it. That's the idea. Get people familiar. Familiar is a great way of introducing some. So QR codes are necessary to engage with society in China. The new CEO of Twitter is World Economic Forum Chair Linda Yaccarino. World Economic Forum Chair Linda Yaccarino has said payments and banking will be a focus for the rebranded business. Further confirmation that this is the cult plan comes with a report in 2022 that Bill Gates is Microsoft is considered building a super app. Benedict Evans, a tech analyst, said, imagine if you used OpenTable, Uber, and Deliveroo entirely inside the Facebook app, using your Facebook identity and a Facebook payment account instead of a credit card, and then you paid for coffee and paid for the tube with it as well. Anything is possible with X, given Musk's role as a cult frontman. But for sure, whatever Musk does with the platform, it won't be in the interests of the people. This is all another step towards the West morphing into China. As I've said many times, China is the blueprint for the West, as have many other people in the alternative media over the years. Israel is also involved with X, not only because of Israel's ultimate ownership of Silicon Valley, but through identity verification for premium members. Musk launched a premium membership known as Twitter Blue, or X Blue now, with various extras and add-ons shortly after he took over the company. An X user uncovered, and I verified after I saw their tweet, that the company that X uses to verify the identity of premium members is called AU10Tix, or All10Tix. The CEO of All10Tix, Ron Atzmon, was a member of Shinbet Unit 8200, which is a security agency in Israel. All10Tix was founded in 2002 as the technology arm of a Dutch company established in 1982 by former members of Shin Bet called ICTS International. A subsidiary company, Huntley USA, was responsible for security gates at airports in Boston and Newark on the day of the 9/11 attacks, which had massive Israeli and Zionist involvement. The plan in the West, indeed globally, is for a digital ID system connected to the internet and the smart grid to dictate access to the essentials of life, food, water, travel, etc., in one centralized digitalized system. The COVID vaccine passports were an attempt at a prototype of this in the West. Elon Musk is in favor of vaccines, especially the COVID fake vaccine and digital ID. The digital ID will contain your social credit score, vaccination history, carbon footprint, and social media score history to create a digital dictatorship. Nanotechnology in the COVID fake vaccine is designed to connect the human body and brain to the smart grid cloud. Elon Musk is sending up satellites to beam this Wi-Fi, 5G with 6G and 7G eventually at the entire Earth, with all the health consequences, to create the global smart grid, the global cloud, with ground-based antenna. Driverless cars are also designed to interact with the smart grid eventually, and Elon Musk is also involved in that through Tesla. Driverless cars will be programmed to take you nowhere authority decides you're not allowed to go. This tyranny is planned to be underpinned by a cashless digital currency, which you will only be allowed to spend on certain things. And if you challenge authority, then or challenge authority too often, then you won't be able to buy anything at all. That's the idea behind a cashless digital currency. One means of achieving this agenda is a universal basic income, a guaranteed income, which Elon Musk is also promoting. And don't just take my word for all this. Here's a clip of Elon Musk and World Economic Forum frontman, cult frontman Klaus Schwab, promoting the same agenda.
If not everybody is vaccinated.
Are you vaccinated?
If I yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm very, very pro-vaccination. Yeah. The science is unequivocal.
Can you imagine that in 10 years when we are sitting here, we have an implant in our brains, and I can immediately feel, because you all will have implants.
Just think of sensors planted into our brains.
Basically implanted in your skull,
So, but it would be flush with your skull. So you basically take out a chunk of skull, replace, put the Neuralink device in there. You put the electrode, you'd insert the electrode threads very carefully into the brain.
It doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take a genetic editing.
It's a fusion of the physical, the digital, and the biological world. That's really the essence of the fourth industrial revolution.
A merger with biological intelligence and machine intelligence.
An effort for man to merge with machine in a healthy way.
Yes.
To beat machines, you basically have to merge with machines.
Most likely, yes.
As work is changing, is a universal basic income really a solution to this problem?
I think ultimately we will have to have some kind of universal basic income. And I think some kind of a universal basic income is going to be necessary.
Decarbonization of the economy.
Where are they traveling? How are they traveling? What are they eating? What are they consuming on the platform? So, individual carbon footprint tracker. Stay tuned. We don't have it operational yet, but this is something that we're working on.
I mean, my top recommendation, honestly, would be just to have a carbon tax.
This global reset is necessary.
Elon Musk is a sales pitcher for the cult's agenda. But now, because he bought Twitter, allegedly for free speech, people think he's a hero when he's on their side, and so he's got a free pass to advance various elements of the cult's agenda with no comment, or next to no comment, from those in the alternative media who would otherwise have been calling him out, championing him as some hero. The agenda also wants smart cities, densely packed cities with people living in high-rise micro-apartments run by smart technology and AI. And I came across this article as I was putting this analysis together. This is in the Activist Post, which does a lot of very good articles. The Wall Street Takeover, How Corporate Landlords Are Reshaping America's Housing Market. In the wake of the Great Recession, a new breed of landlords has emerged, corporate investors. These Wall Street-backed entities have been quietly amassing vast portfolios of single-family homes, particularly in economically distressed neighborhoods. Now a team of researchers led by Carol Camp Yeke, the Marshall S. Snow Professor of Arts and Sciences at Washington University, is launching a two-year national study to examine the implications of this trend, especially for marginalized communities of color. The study builds upon Camp Yeke's recent paper, Corporate Investors in the Housing Affordability Crisis, Having Wall Street as Your Landlord, published in January in the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. The paper details how the foreclosure crisis of the late 2000s created a perfect storm for corporate investors to snap up thousands of homes at bargain prices. Our research details how corporate investors buy low and rent high to populations who can least afford it. Camp Yeke says in a university release, as wages have stagnated and the cost of housing has risen, an increasing number of Americans are now being priced out of the housing market entirely. The tactics employed by corporate landlords are concerning. Camp Yeke's research found that they often maximise profits at the expense of tenant safety and well-being, including massive rent increases, eviction filings, dangerous lack of maintenance, steep fines and more. Some have even likened this targeting of low-income Latino and black homeowners to a form of modern-day redlining. By shining a light on this issue, the researchers hope to spur important conversations about how the federal government can address the housing affordability crisis. Proposed solutions include increased housing subsidies, creating incentives for local governments to allow moderately priced homes, and providing targeted federal investments and tax incentives for first-time homebuyers in distressed communities. As America grapples with the aftermath of the pandemic and the ongoing challenges of inequality, with the question of who owns our homes and who profits from them, has never been more pressing. With studies like this one leading the charge, we may be one step closer to ensuring that the American dream of home ownership remains within reach for all. Well, that's not the idea. Very much the opposite. The plan is to clear the land and herd people into cities. Now, you can't achieve this agenda with the global population, even in the West, never mind wider afield, with the population size of Western countries as they are, because there's too many people. And this is where the depopulation agenda comes in, as I've been talking about now for decades. And the COVID fake vaccine, so supported by Elon Musk, is a fundamental contribution to that very depopulation agenda, which plays out in many and various ways. Toxins in food and drink and in the air, even cleaning products, can you believe? Radiation, not least from the very smart grid cloud, which Elon Musk is helping to advance and create. Food, etc. The targeting of farmers to get them off their land is all part of this agenda. The plan is to introduce synthetic food with nowhere near the same nutritional value as natural food. Elon Musk claims to oppose the agenda of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum while promoting and advancing their agenda, because Musk, Schwab and the World Economic Forum are all fronts for the global cult. The World Economic Forum are promoting eating insects. The agenda of the global cult plans not just to turn food synthetic, but humans as well. You are what you eat. The more synthetic material you can put into the body through food and the COVID fake vaccine, the more synthetic the body will be. And on the subject of the COVID fake vaccine, here's some more optimism. This is an article on the BBC News website. COVID jab skipped by 44%, study of the entirety of the UK finds. More than 7,000 COVID-related hospital admissions could have been prevented in the UK in the summer of 2022 if the population had received the full number of jabs recommended, according to research in The Lancet. Some 44% of the UK population was under-vaccinated, with younger people among the most likely to skip doses. In a first, health records for everyone over 5 in the UK were analysed. The same approach could now be used to understand other diseases. The entire population of the UK is 67 million, and all those over the age of 5 had their anonymised electronic health data analysed for the Lancet study. It found that between June and September 2022, the percentage of people not fully vaccinated against COVID was 49.8% in Northern Ireland, 45.7% in England, 34% in Scotland, 32.8% in Wales. And that was based on the number of COVID vaccine doses recommended for different age groups. With about 40,000 severe hospital admissions related to COVID during that summer, the research estimates that more than 17% would have been avoided if everyone had taken up the offer of the vaccine and booster doses for which they were eligible. The research used data on COVID vaccinations and tests, as well as from GPs and hospitals, to track health data for the whole population. They then looked at the relationship between the under-vaccinated and severe COVID illness. They found that under-vaccinated people over 75 were more than twice as likely to be seriously ill with COVID than those who were fully protected. The article continues. There was also a link between skipping doses and hospitalisation and death rates in all age groups studied. Professor Sir Aziz Sheikh, study co-lead and director of the Usher Institute at the University of Edinburgh, said the research showed COVID vaccines save lives. Although vaccine uptake was high at the start of the pandemic, that declined over subsequent waves of the virus, and health officials were no longer clear about the overall picture. As new variants emerge, this study will help to pinpoint groups of our society in areas of the country where public health campaigns should be focused and tailored for those communities, Professor Sheikh said. The groups most likely to turn down the invitation to be vaccinated were younger people, men, those living in poorer areas, and those from ethnic minority groups. This was similar for all UK nations. The difference in rates of under-vaccinated between nations is thought to be because of overall population size, demographics and political approach. Professor Cathy Sudlow, Chief Scientist at Health Data Research UK, a consortium of researchers who worked on the study, said collecting NHS data on this scale across the four nations of the UK had huge potential. We believe that we could and should extend these approaches to many other areas of medicine, such as cancer, heart disease and diabetes, to search for better understanding, prevention and treatment of. I talk about the connection of transgender to this synthetic human agenda in the previous episode. So, what can we do? Well, one thing we can do is not fall for cult front people like Elon Musk and tech investors who have infiltrated the alternative media and are leading people off the edge of the cliff. Questioning everything is necessary. A massive contribution people can make is challenging the tech agenda and not preparing children for it by buying them iPads and smartphones, just for the sake of keeping them quiet. If you're a parent, you could encourage your child to go and play outside to get some exercise and fresh air. there's lots of things we can do to bring an end to this unfolding nightmare dystopia. We just have to make the choice to do it.
So that's it for this week. That's the news, that's the contesting connections, that's pay-per-view. More to come next week. Until then, goodbye.